Hi everyone, today we're talking with Steve Hayes. He's the professor of psychology at the University of Nevada, and he's also the author of 32 books and over 400 scientific articles, and was the pioneer in developing the treatment and method, Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. Now he has a number one best-selling self-help book, Get Out of Your Mind and Into Your Life, and it's a fantastic resource for learning more about his approach, and I think that the insights he shares in the book can be extremely powerful. So I'm really looking forward to talking with him, and I'm happy that Steve was kind enough to take some time out of this schedule and answer some of my questions so all of you can benefit. So first and foremost, thanks a lot, Steve.
Sure. Happy to be here.
Great. Can you start by explaining a little bit about what ACT is and what role it can play in treating anxiety disorders and phobias?
Well, acceptance and commitment therapy, or ACT, is a combination of acceptance and mindfulness processes, commitment and behavior change processes that are designed to produce what we call psychological flexibility. What we mean by psychological flexibility is the ability to contact how your history projects into the present moment and gives you thoughts, feelings, memories, and bodily sensations, some of which you may like, some of which you don't like, but all of which has something to do with your history in the current context. We're kind of historical beings. I mean, we're not sort of behaving randomly. And based on what the situation affords, given if you can show up to what your history brings in, we teach people to look at what they really want to have occur in that situation and shift their attention towards that, to do that way in a kind of self-compassionate way, and then link their behavior to their chosen values instead of simply to a struggle with the world within. I think anxiety has this quality of announcing itself as being negative and unwelcome. It's a danger signal. It's something that evokes struggle, avoidance, running, fighting. And all of that sometimes prevents us from learning the positive messages that are inside anxiety, and it narrows our ability to behave in new and creative ways in given situations. And a thing I often do when I'm asked to talk about this in workshops and so forth is I will ask somebody near me if it's all right if I squeeze their neck. Not so hard that they'll pass out, but just to make a point. In fact, I don't, but I'll just put my hands around their neck as kind of in a ring. And I said, if I squeezed really hard here, how many things in your life would be important? And they always say one, getting your hands off my neck. But that's exactly the kind of situation that anxiety gets us into, in which our own history is a big problem, and in a way our life becomes a problem. So instead of a process to be lived, our life is a problem to be solved. And especially, it's the mind sort of tells us that the way we're going to solve it is by not having our history echo into the present in the way that it does. That means we're focusing on that hand that's around our neck, and suddenly instead of thousands of things that might happen in a situation that might be fun, interesting, creative, new learning that might connect us with others, that allow us to step up to the challenges of making contributions or loving or playing or being there with the people that we love, instead of that, we're focused on the anxiety hands that are clutching us around our neck and waiting for them to go away before life can start. So we try to get focused on how life can start now instead of waiting for something to change in the world within. And the acceptance and mindfulness processes give you a way to do that as you begin to show genuine curiosity towards the rising and falling of anxiety, to see where in your body it happens, to notice when it's evoked, but also learn how to shift your attention towards what you most deeply care about and carry your life forward, including the parts that you don't like. I don't know many people who like anxiety feelings, but to carry that forward into a life worth living. We've looked at the impact of this approach with quite a number of problems, including anxiety problems of various kinds, and it seems to be a generally useful way to approach the world within.
Well, that's a really powerful and an accurate visual that you gave there with the hands around the neck.
I
like that. Now, in your book, you talk about the fact that human suffering is universal. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Well, we think these processes, you know, I always shudder when I say this because, you know, I think deeply. You're talking to a person who is a panic disordered person in recovery. It's part of how ACT occurred. And so I understand a little bit about struggles with anxiety from the world within myself. And so what I'm about to say, I understand, can seem invalidating. But let me just say it this way. I think people who suffer have the idea that there's something very, very special about their suffering. There's something unusual about them. And in a way that's disturbing, you know, like I'm broken, I'm damaged, there's something wrong with me. But in a way, it's kind of almost soothing. At least if I'm not living the kind of life I want to live, there's something kind of spectacular about my suffering. In fact, I hope this isn't taken the wrong way, but most people who have anxiety problems are suffering, I believe, based on entirely normal processes. I mean, there may be biological predispositions towards being able to associate negative events more easily that will give you a kind of a background. Some people are edgier, more high-strung, can become anxious more easily. But the tendency to look at the world within, categorize it into things you like and you don't like, try to take action to remove the things that you don't like, and to do that before you move ahead in your life. In other words, to treat your internal world as a problem to be solved. That is as common as dirt. It's built into human language. Human language evolved as a problem-solving tool, and we've used it very well, thank you, as a species. We've taken over the planet as a result of our ability to project a future and to weigh possible outcomes for doing this or doing that. We can solve problems just sitting in a chair without even moving, thinking it through well. But once you turn that common process and that very useful process from the world without to the world within, you now are just a hair breadth away, if you have the wrong combination of things, to turning your life into a war that has to be fought and won before you can start living. And with the right trauma or the right critical parent or the right loss or just the inadvertent stumbling into a panic attack. I mean, you look at the history, to take a specific anxiety disorder, you look at the history of panic disorder. I suppose I'm interested in it because it's the disorder I personally visited for a long time and still, knock on wood, I think I'm connected to as a person in recovery from it. You know, people can stumble into that by a bad drug trip. They can stumble into that by a hypoglycemic attack. They can do it on the basis of food poisoning or in physical illness. I mean, the conditions under which people have anxiety attacks sometimes are entirely understandable. But then this process begins. You know, oh my goodness, where else would this happen? And what does it mean about me that it happened? And oh, how humiliating it would be. And am I losing my mind? And I'm going to die. And I'm going crazy. And I have to go to the emergency room. And next thing you know, you're in this process of spiraling down into an anxiety struggle. I think that basic MO is kind of part of most of the anxiety disorders. And so what we have done is we've tried to develop knowledge about what are the verbal processes that lead to this. And we think it's really essentially the verbal processes that allow problem solving, which are to be able to take events, dissemble them into features, to predict the future based on what you might do with those attributes and to weigh them. If you think of language as kind of a learned process, one of the things that learning psychology tells you, the psychology of learning tells you, is that there is no process called unlearning. It doesn't exist. I mean, short of a lobotomy, we don't know any way of removing history. Everything is always building on our history because we're historical beings. So this problem-solving approach, it's as if we're trying to erase part of our history. But the more we do that, the more we elaborate that part of our history. So the more you're if you just sort of ask yourself this question, as you focus on anxiety, is anxiety getting more important or less important? Well, of course, it's getting more important. Well, for a person with an anxiety problem, that may be the last thing you want to do. So how do you make it less important? You don't make it less important by suppression, by pushing it away, by focusing on changing it. Turns out, and we've developed a basic theory of language and cognition, and we've done the basic research to understand this, although you can't subtract these kind of verbal and cognitive relations that remind you of anxiety, that cause you to evaluate anxiety as negative and so forth, you can do things that diminish its relative importance in the next moment and in the next. A way of saying that is you can reduce its function, but not its form, not its appearance, not the things it's connected to. So, for example, if I teach you to look at the flow of events with genuine curiosity, the way a little kid might look at a bug crawling across the backyard, that's a different frame of mind from this kind of scary problem-solving mode of mind that we usually apply. So we teach people processes of openness, curiosity. We call it acceptance, but acceptance can be a dangerous word. We don't mean tolerance, resignation. We mean active engagement of reaching out and feeling what's there to be felt and really taking the time. Like, what if it's actually important to actually notice how this works? The other thing we teach is kind of attentional flexibility. Not to make the anxiety go away, but simply because ultimately it's pretty boring to have your life be about anxiety. What else could we do in this situation? So now that we've spent some time watching it, are there other things? Open our eyes, look around, what's here? I'll give you a kind of a metaphorical example of what I'm talking about. If we were working, let's say, with a person with a panic disorder and doing exposure, which ultimately an act we would do, more towards the end, after we teach people these acceptance and mindfulness skills and work out on the values side what they really want to have happen in their life. But let's say I'm in a mall with a person who hasn't gone into a mall for a long time. We'll spend some time watching anxiety arise and fall inside the person's body. We'll notice what their thoughts are. We'll notice what kind of memories this reminds you of. We'll kind of look at what shows up. But then, you know, we'll also spend some time looking at what are the interesting things we could buy here, or who has the funniest hairdo, or what do you think that person does for a living? So you kind of come out into the world, and there's a lot more things to do in a mall than to struggle with your anxiety. There's thousands of things there. There's beautiful things to look at. There's things to buy. There's people watching to do. Not to subtract the anxiety and make it go away, because that brings your attention back to the anxiety, but simply to sort of note that, you know, thank you, remind very much, okay, I'm anxious. Now what else is there to do here? And so turns out when you do that, no, you do not erase the cognitive maps that we have, but you give them different functions. So you can have scary thoughts without becoming entangled with them. You can have difficult memories without doing very much about it, and you can move ahead in your life. So, for example, as a person with a panic history, if I go into Macy's to this day, 15, 20, 25 years later after the panic attack that I had there, I'll remember that attack. I'll remember what it felt like to not be able to find the escalator and to have this thought like they're just going to find me on the second floor and I'm never going to get down, and you know, you're trying to find the way out and all of that. And would I want not to remember that? I mean, what kind of person would I have to be to so arrange my world that important things that have happened to me in my life could be erased? You know, like plugging into the Matrix or taking the I'm Clear drug, you know, these kind of movies they have about, you know, what this kind of fantasy we have sometime that we could push the delete button. And if we could push the delete button, I think we'd delete a whole lot of our lives and we would be less of human beings for it. So you want to kind of notice that and notice what brings to mind, but then it's also time to go buy a new pot or pan for my wife. It's also time to, you know, to look at whether or not they have some new jeans for me to wear. And that's the kind of thing that we can teach, and that will put anxiety in its place. It's not going to subtract it, but it puts it as just one of many experiences that human beings have.
That's great. Yeah, I noticed that in the book you use the term willingness instead of acceptance, instead of acceptance so much. Can you kind of explain what that distinction is?
Well, willingness is this kind of answer to yes to the question of will you have me as I am, and are, you know, think of willingness as just will you, like, so will you go to the mall, will you? Inside an anxiety struggle, often the question is, yes, I will, if, and now I'm about to get in trouble, if I'm not too anxious. Yeah, but once you're there, you're not taking a kind of leap forward. You're still basically saying, my life is determined by that my history and what the current situation evokes, not by me. So in a way, I don't get to answer yes as to will you go to the mall, or will you go to that movie, or will you be on this radio show, or, you know, will you take that trip? You now are no longer in control of your life. In the interest of getting in control of your mind and your emotions, you lose control of your life. Right. If you can answer yes to the world within, yes, I will allow myself to feel what I feel, think what I think, remember what I remember, and do what I choose to do that best serves the kind of life that I would like to live. That's a kind of a yes, yes, yes answer that is empowering to people. And it's if you wanted to give a word to it, it's a very confident thing to do in the etymologically sensible meaning of that, meaning with fidelity, confidence. There's a kind of self-fidelity that's in the acceptance and mindfulness work that doesn't buy into this idea that your mind gives you, that you have to be someone else with a different history before you can start living, which basically comes down to start from where you're not. And nobody knows how to start from where they're not. If you're an anxiety-disordered person, you got to start from where you are, and guess what? That's going to include a lot of anxiety. And what life is asking of you is it okay to be you and to move towards the kind of life that you want? And that's the yes answer. If the answer is yes, then that means, yes, I will feel what I feel. Yes, I will think what I think. And yes, I will do what will take me in the direction of what I choose to value, what I choose to hold as important. I think most people who are struggling with anxiety have inadvertently chosen to hold anxiety as what it's important. But it's kind of an empty life in this sense. Very few people would want to write on their tombstone, you know, here lies Steve, you know, he struggled with anxiety for his entire life.
Right.
It isn't really the kind of life you want. It's the one you feel you have to have. And when you do it successfully, then you'll be able to have the kind of life you want. So life gets put on hold. But that's an illusion. You can have life be about what you want it to be about now. You want it to be about intimate relationships, step forward in intimate relationships. Yeah, but I'm too anxious. Take your anxiety with you. Where did the T-O-O part come? What would anxiety look like if you took that kind of leap of faith, that willingness leap, and kind of jumped out into the space of, I am going to be where I am when I'm there without needless defense. And I'm not turning my life over to these emotional echoes of the past.
Well, I think that's great. And one of the things that really stood out to me in your book that I remembered was the metaphor that you used about the hungry tiger. Can you tell everyone what that is?
Well, the point of that is you get pulled into, here's one of the problems that happens, is that all of evolutionary history, as an animal learning guy, this is kind of where I started, you know, literally running rats and pigeons before becoming a clinical psychologist. Everything we know about learning processes tells us that what happens now is more important than what happens then. It's this basic, almost irrational process that the immediate effects of our actions are more determinative over behavior, unless we do things to counteract it, than the more long-term effects. A person who avoids, withdraws, makes compromises with difficult emotions, even when that costs them the ability to move forward in their life towards what they really value, the immediate effect of that almost always is positive. I remember when I was really in the middle of an anxiety struggle, being invited to give a talk to a group, and I figured out a way to tag one of my graduate students with a talk. And I felt so great. You know, I had this horrible burden, you know, of, you know, having to give this talk, and then as soon as I could figure out a way to dump it, I just felt so great. For about half an hour. But then after that, it's, but what about the next talk? Mm-hmm. And now the next talk is even bigger. It's more fearsome. And the metaphor of feeding the tiger is it's very much like this, you know, a baby tiger. It doesn't look like it completely will take over your life, and you throw it a chunk of meat, but then it's going to get a little bigger. And the chunk of meat you just threw was a little slice of your own life and your ability flexibly to move towards things that you care about. I actually wanted to give that talk in the sense of I thought it could make a contribution. I avoided it in order to sort of self-soothe on the difficult emotions of giving the talk. But then giving the next talk was even scarier. And part of what happened in my own process is eventually giving a lecture in the class got so scary I could hardly do it, which meant basically my life as a teacher was close to over. And there's only so many films you can show in a class before they get the idea something's wrong. You know, by the time we realize that, by the time we face that, for if you're in a person who's made a lot of compromises with anxiety or depression or substance use urges or whatever the tiger you've been feeding, sometimes these tigers are big, big-looking beasts, and they're now it's it almost seems impossible not to feed it. You know, it's right out of Feed Me. What is that? Little Shop of Horrors. You have the horror of that gigantic tiger demanding to be fed with your own lifeblood. Turns out that tiger is not outside of you. It's within you. It's not bigger than you. It's an emotion that you have. It's within you. It's not possible for emotions to be bigger than you. And if you can find a way to hold it, to actually move towards it instead of away from it, you have the capacity to carry even the fearsome anxiety that we can build up based on the logical mind doing what it does and building anxiety into a huge problem. And I don't want to make it sound as though it's easy, because it isn't. It's not so much hard, effortful, it's just hard, tricky. It's very hard to rein in your logical mind when it's a one-trick pony. I mean, the things that our logical mind knows how to do are so dominantly problem-solving. It's only with some effort that you can teach it that there is another channel to tune into that is this acceptance and mindfulness approach, where you can put consciousness to the process of gently noticing, of making room for, of observing, of being curious about, but also connecting with what it is you really want. And instead of trying to solve a problem, focus instead on, you know, where the vitality is, where the joy is, where the connections are, where the contributions are to be made.
Certainly things that I think everyone could stand to focus a little bit more on, especially people that have anxiety disorders. In your book, you devote a few chapters to thoughts, and I know that, you know, really bothersome, repetitive, and scary thoughts can be one of the more frightening aspects of anxiety. Can you talk a little bit why thoughts are so important and what we need to understand about them?
Well, because if acceptance is important on the emotional side, mindfulness, or what we call diffusion, which is a neologism, we made up the word, but it means sort of not reacting with your thoughts simply literally, but also sort of mindfully watching them as an ongoing process. The problem is that, you know, language works pretty well when you take the words to be about what they say they are about. When you sort of fail to notice even the thoughts, I mean, the worst thoughts are the ones that we're thinking that we almost don't notice, we just assume. We look from them rather than looking at them. You know, like, this is, you know, my life's not livable. I'm bad. This is impossible. This isn't, you know, et cetera. Most of those won't announce themselves as thoughts. It isn't, I'm having the thought I'm bad, or I'm having the thought that this life is not livable. And so inside normal, evaluative, temporal, problem-solving, literal language, we kind of disappear into the word machine. And we lose ourselves in our evaluative and temporal thoughts, in the positives and negatives, the likes and dislikes, and the future and the past that thoughts will take you to. All of that's occurring right here, right now, in the present, as a process of thinking. And so what we teach people to do is to see thoughts as thoughts. And we have a whole host of ways of doing that, and Get Out of Your Mind, Into Your Life, the workbook you mentioned, but not just that. I don't want to sound like a commercial. There's quite a number of ACT books out there, including you've had John Forsyth on right. with his ACT book for anxiety disorders and so forth. Right. You know, all of them are going to include methods to train people to watch your thoughts. Now, let me just give you an example. Suppose this wouldn't apply to everybody, but it might apply to enough people who listen to this that you can relate to it. When I chased my own anxiety, I could find deep inside there a scared kid. I mean, I remember some of the early experiences that were part of what later became my anxiety disorder, and they went back to being 8 years old. If you had an 8-year-old, just as an example, and for the people listening, if you think about the times when you were afraid as a child, if you imagine that child right in front of you saying, I'm afraid, you're probably not going to criticize them for that. You're probably not going to say, well, of course, that means there's something wrong with you, or that means you're bad. With your own mind, you'll do that. An example of a diffusion exercise. The next time you're having scary thoughts, say them in the voice of the child who first was afraid, and just see what it pulls from you. Like, what would it be like if your thoughts, like, I have to get out of here, were heard in the voice of an 8-year-old? You know, it doesn't mean that you have to get out of here. When you're in your normal mode of mind, I have to get out of here is not even noticed as a thought. It's just that I have to get out of here. So we have hundreds of diffusion methods in these self-help books. And what they do is they help catch this illusion of disappearing into your mind and notice the process. I've just given you one. If you don't like that, and I'll say this other one, the reason I'm saying the other one this other way second is that there's something invalidating, almost as if we should ridicule our thoughts. And I wanted to start one with one, like the image of yourself as a child being afraid, okay, to show that it's not a matter of ridicule. But if you don't like that, say your scary thoughts in the voice of Donald Duck. Say it in the voice of George Bush. Or if you like George Bush in the voice of Obama, or sing your thoughts, say them very slowly, say them over and over and over again until they lose all meaning. see how many different words you can make out of the scariest word inside a thought. Reverse the order. Write them down and look at them like a script for a movie. Imagine that you're seeing them in a movie. I mean, there's so many things you can do. Imagine that your thoughts are like clouds. Just watch them float by. If they come back, watch them float by again. So this kind of more mindful, accepting, just noticing one, and also noticing there's many different ways of interacting with your thoughts. After all, they are just programmed historical verbal material. Most of the thoughts we have, you don't remember where they came from. In therapy, I will sometimes set this up. I will give somebody something to remember, like ABC, and they'll tell them, well, what did I say, ABC? If I told you, if I came back a week from now, if you remember this, I'll give you $1,000. Could you remember it? I think so. Well, let's see. What are the letters, ABC? You know, you just do that two or three times, and you could come back in a week, and they'd remember it. You could probably come back in a month, and they'd remember it. You might come back in a year, they'd remember it. Well, the people listening to us right now who have struggled with anxiety have gone around and around and around like a train on tracks with some of these thoughts 100 times, 1,000 times, so just over and over, like chug, 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 chug. You know, those thoughts are never going to go away. I mean, what are the letters? ABC. I mean, they're never going to go away. That's how fast they happen. So to program the mind like I just did gives you just a little distance, you know, like the next time your mind gives you a thought that it's announcing is really, really, really important. You might want to recall that this is just a very basic relational organ in between your ears that knows how to pull that trick. And it doesn't mean what it says it means. There's a comedian somewhere that said, I used to think my mind was my most important organ until I realized which organ was telling me that. You know, there's more to us than the words in between our ears. And if we practice meditation and silence, we practice these diffusion and mindfulness skills, you can notice these things ebb and flow and float by without turning your life over to them. So thought is a critical thing because of its pull to entanglement, which sometimes is very useful. If you're reading a novel, it's fine to disappear into it. If you're doing your taxes, it's fine to know all the rules. But when you're in the anxiety movie, yet again, you know, maybe something else is needed here to get a little air in the room, to get some flexibility in here, to do something other than what we've been doing over and over and over again, like that train on tracks.
Right. Yeah, I've said a few times that it only feels like the truth because you've repeated it so much, and I think that's kind of what you're getting at, too. Now, what do you mean when you say learning how to jump in your book?
Well, jump is this... Okay. There's several places where your mind demands information about the process and wants reassurance. Suppose living inside that very process is part of the problem. Suppose that's a mode of mind, that's a problem-solving, literal, temporal, evaluative mode of mind in which new behaviors can't occur. So, for example, if I ask a client of... you know, would they be willing to experience their anxiety fully and without defense? And we can limit it only by time and situation. Metaphorically, it's like learning how to jump. I mean, you can jump from a stool, or you can jump from a chair, or you can jump from the roof, or you can jump from an airplane. But if you try to turn jumping and stepping down, then I can jump from the stool or the chair, but I can't. Rather, I can step down from the stool or chair, but I can't step down from the roof or the airplane. So what your mind wants you to do is say, the metaphor of stepping down is, I want to be in control at every point along the way and have the ability to pull back. So I'm willing to go there as long as the anxiety doesn't get too high. Well, that means you're not willing to go there because you didn't determine how high the anxiety goes. And so we practice leaping in the sense of arranging conditions where people can make choices and let go of control. You can limit it by time and situation. So you can choose to go into the 7-Eleven for 30 seconds, fine. But while you're in there, we abandoned control. People, you know, anxiety patients often say that they're worried about getting out of control.
Right, right.
In my approach, really that's what we want to do. We want to get out of control. That doesn't mean out of control.
Right, right. Yeah.
But turns out, trying to stay in control means you lose control of your life. I mean, often people struggling with anxiety have that sense that they're no longer in control of their life. So what kind of control are we talking about? I mean, look at the fruits that this effort has produced. And if that's going to be the result, let's go in a different direction. So leaping is this practice of putting yourself in a situation in which you have mindfully and by choice abandoned control for a bracketed by time and situation. So for these 30 seconds that I'm in the 7-Eleven, whatever shows up. If you're going to kill me, kill me. You know, dear anxiety history, you know, see if you can do it. Of course, you know, most people have had the experience. There's an ebb and flow to anxiety disorders, and most people who have them have had an experience of getting so damn mad at it, so exasperated, so fed up that, you know, it's sort of like, you know, come get me, kill me if you're going to do it. And it's a very common experience to have it lift at those times. And there's a sense of release. And then right behind it, the logical mind figures that it's figured out the trick. It has a new way. It can actually control it. All you have to do is just be mad or give up, and then you'll be able to control it. And, of course, then that spoils the fun. You're told that it's right now back into this problem-solving mode of mind, which is where anxiety struggles reside. So nobody's keeping score. There's not a speedometer glued to anybody's forehead. So it's not like you have to go at any particular speed. You know, if somebody's terrified of a mall, we don't have to tomorrow go marching in the mall and just roll around on the floor quivering. Although I've done that with patients. I literally lied down on the floor with patients. And if I'm going to ask somebody to do it, I'm going to do it. So we literally lie down there together and go, help, help, I'm losing my mind, and things like that. But, you know, that's a pretty high-level deal. Most people wouldn't do something that nutty,
right,
without really getting on to this playful reverse compass, that it's actually possible to shift from fear of anxiety to, you know, poking the tiger and daring it to eat you.
Right.
So some of the initial leaps will be very small. I remember negotiating down with a client to, would you be willing to feel anxiety without any struggle for a second? You know, if that's where we're going to start, that's fine, as long as it's the real deal. Like, whatever's inside that second, I'm not going to blink. And then we'll go from there. If from that, you can build a life.
Well, my last question is kind of a big one, and it might be difficult to answer on the spot, but if you had just one insight or piece of advice for people listening that are struggling with anxiety or panic attacks or phobias, what would it be?
Well, I would ask the question of, what if what your experience is telling you is valid? It's a little tricky to say it that way because your mind has filtered it so much, but most people who are looking for another way have really tried an awful lot of things. And I think there's some wisdom in that. If these things are not working, maybe it's time for something different, but maybe truly different. Maybe so different that it's even outside of what your normal mode of mind can conceive. There's another variant on that, which is, I think, the same thing. What if inside this anxiety struggle there's actually something here that's important to you and that can help guide you? A way that I've done this sometimes is I'll have someone write down the things that are most painful, that they most want to have go away in the world within. And then I have them flip it over and I say, write down what this says about what you value. And initially there's kind of a pause, like, what are you talking about? But if you look a little more carefully, you can usually see it. Like, what would you have to not care about for that thing you just wrote down to not be a problem? There's two knots in there, so you got to parse that sentence. But, okay, so let's say my own case. I struggled a lot with anxiety, especially social anxiety, giving talks, getting out there among people, going to parties. As I dug into that, what I felt was that really it wasn't that I was afraid of people. It was that I was afraid I wouldn't be able to make a contribution, that I wanted to be loved by people, to be connected with people, and make a contribution to people, and I didn't think I was up to it. Well, if you've written that on one side, on the other side, you've written, I want to be connected with other people and make a contribution. What if what that life is asking of you is it okay to have both sides of this coin? Your logical mind says, I don't want one side of the coin, and I'm going to put the other side on hold until this side is erased. But if you actually look at your experience, life doesn't expand in that, it contracts in that. And what if your experience is valid? What if that's not because there's something wrong with you and you're not implementing it right? But that's a natural consequence of trying to erase one side. You essentially are trying to throw away a coin that has two sides. Well, if I'm going to take this coin on purpose, it means that this anxiety that I'm struggling with is actually connected to something that's dear for me. I'll give you another little thing about my own history that would make sense of that. I don't want to present this as sort of insight or something, but, as I walked down this path, it was a number of years, 8 or 9 years in, before I found inside my panic, not just the desire to be with others, to contribute to others, but I also found this 8-year-old kid hiding under the bed while mom and dad are fighting in the other room, and dad's drunk, and mom's depressed, and the pain of that little guy is right there with me when I'm feeling anxiety. But so is what he wanted to do, which was to go out there and find a way to help these two people who loved each other to treat each other well. And I'm a psychologist. That's what I do. I write books. I do therapy. I supervise. It's turned out to be the central theme of my life. If I'm going to say to that scared little kid, get the hell away from me, snap out of it, what's the matter with you, slap him a few times, which is all of what I was doing when I was trying to make anxiety go away, because I came by anxiety, honestly, it's part of my history. That little guy was part of it. It's so harsh and has like so little self-compassion. But if instead I kind of bring that anxiety close and then flip it over and say, what does this say about what I really want here? And then maybe me and the 8-year-old part of me, yeah, he's afraid, but the adult part of me is not going to abandon him. I'm not going to criticize him, slap him, or make him be different. Instead, I'm going to walk out there into the other room, and I'm going to start working on helping other people and myself, but helping people who are suffering. I'm going to try to make a contribution. So the flip side, you get the flip side if you're willing to have this other side. Inside your anxiety struggles, there's a value in there. And if you can kind of connect with your whole history, take that two-sided coin, put it in your back pocket, and walk forward, it's kind of another variant of what if your experience is valid? What if even your anxiety is not your enemy? And what if your life is not a problem to be solved, but a process to be lived? What if it's okay to be you? I don't think you get there just by artificially forcing in yes with the agenda that means it'll suddenly feel easy or confident or that the anxiety will go away. It's more like yes. It's okay to be me, even the scared little 8-year-old, even the parts of me that feel most frightened. And I'm willing to flip that coin over and carry the whole coin forward, that my life be what's written on the other side. What do I really want to be about in my life, and what do I want to make manifest or bring into the world by the moments that I've got on this planet?
Yeah, I think a lot of people with anxiety disorders can probably probably relate to that 8-year-old boy that you're talking about. I know that.
Yeah. And yet, so much of what we do in said anxiety disorders is so harsh, so empty of self-compassion. You know, it's tantamount to slapping that kid and say, "Don't be afraid," or "Stop crying, or I'll give you something to cry about."
Sure.
And when we were children, that felt pretty terrible. I think it's still true when you do it to ourselves as adults. So ACT gives this other way forward that I think is more self-compassionate, but yet not rolling around in emotions endlessly in some sort of cathartic vision. You know, if you only hurt enough, or you know, that somehow life will start. I mean, I want to get on about the business of living, but do it in a way that's gentle and kind.
Well, Steve, that's all the time that we have for now, but I want to thank you once again for being so generous with your time and for sharing all that you did and your personal history. And just once again, for everyone, the book that we've been talking about is Get Out of Your Mind and Into Your Life, and it's available at Amazon and through your website, I'm sure. And I think everyone should just go out and get a copy, because we've only scratched the surface here today, but you know, as you've heard, the insights and the things that Steve shares and that they're incredible and powerful, and it's one of the books that I really enjoyed reading. Is there a website that people can go to learn a little bit more about you and to see the other?
Well, I've really done one that, I mean, there's an international group that is developing ACT and its underlying theory, and it's called the Association for Contextual Behavioral Science. Its URL is www.contextualpsychology, all one word, contextualpsychology.org. And there's a section of that called ACT for the Public. And you'll see there about 35 self-help books for almost anything you can imagine, including quite a number of anxiety disorders. And, you know, there's some stuff about me and so forth, but it's a much, much larger community. And there's also a listserv called ACT for the Public that people can participate in for free, just to talk with others who are walking through this process of trying to adopt a more accepting and mindful and values-based style of living.
Okay. Well, great. Well, Stephen, once again, thanks a lot, and I will appreciate you talking to me, and we'll talk to you soon.
Good deal, and thanks for allowing me to contribute to y'all.
Absolutely.
Let me know if there's any way I can be of help to you.
Thank you. Appreciate it, Stephen. Talk to you soon.